वासुदेवाय। ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। Reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 10, Chapter 68, The Marriage of Sambha, Text 6 through 10, I think. Okay, just to keep you on your toes, I think we'll do Text 8 responsibly in the middle of those, and we'll read the rest of them. Okay, we can read responsibly starting from Text 6, read together, not responsibly. Dristvanudanvita Sambho Dhartarashtran Maharata Prigriha Ruchiram Chapam Tastau Singha Ivaikala. Seeing Duryodhana and his companions rushing toward him, Sambha, the great chariot fighter, took up his splendid bow and stood alone like a lion. 7. Tam te jagraksava krudhas tishta tishte tibasina Asadya danvino bhanai karna granya samakiran. Determined to capture him, the angry bowman led by Karna shouted at Sambha, "Stand and fight! Stand and fight!" They came straight for him and showered him with arrows. So now we'll do text 8 responsibly. So pivita kuro shresta. So pavida kuru shreshta kurubhir yadunandana namrishyatara chintyarbha singha shudra mrgayar iva. So pavida kuru shreshta Kurubir Yadunandana Namrishatara Chintyarbha Singha Shudra Mrgayariva. So Pavida Kuru Shresta Kurubir Yadunandana Namrishyatara Chintyarbha Singha Shudra Mrgayariva. Ladies. So, he, a pavida, unjustly attacked. Kurushesta, O best of the Kurus, Pariktit Maharaj, Kurubi, by the Kurus, Yadunandana, the dear son of the Yadu dynasty, Na amrishyat. Did not tolerate. Tat. It. Achintya. Of the inconceivable Lord Krishna. Arba. The child. Singha. A lion. Chudra. Insignificant. Mrigai. By animals. Eva. As. Translation and purport by the disciples of Srila Prabhupada. O best of the Kurus, as Krishna's son Samba was being unjustly harassed by the Kurus, that darling of the Yadu dynasty did not tolerate their attack any more than a lion would tolerate an attack by puny animals. Purport. Commenting on the word achintyarbha, Srila Prabhupada writes in Krishna, Samba, the glorious son of the Yadu dynasty, was endowed with inconceivable potencies as the son of Lord Krishna. And we'll finish with 9 and 10. Vishpurja ruchiram chapam sarvam vidyatasayakai karnadin sadratandiras tadvadbir yugapat pritak chaturbish chaturovahan aika kena chasaratin ratinascha maheshvasam tasya tate bhyapujayan. Translation, twanging his wonderful bow, heroic Samba struck with arrows the six warriors headed by Karna. He pierced the chariots with as many arrows, each team of four horses with four arrows, and each chariot driver with a single arrow. And he similarly struck the great bowman who commanded the chariots. The enemy warriors congratulated Samba for his display of prowess. Report, Srila Prabhupada comments, while Samba was so diligently fighting alone with six great warriors, they all appreciated the inconceivable potency of the boy. Even in the midst of fighting, they admitted frankly that this boy Samba was wonderful. Om Jnana Kavrandasya, Kinanjana Salakaya, Chakshurimitamena, Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha. Vanchakalpaturvishcha, Kripasindu Bevicha, Patitano, Pavanego, Vaishnavi, Namo Namaha. So it's interesting that Samba was fighting with six great warriors headed by Karna, Duryodhana, and the sons of Somadatta. And they, in the midst of that, he was very much holding his own. In fact, he was really almost in command, even fighting against these six great Maharatis. So these warriors admired Samba's prowess. Even in the middle of the battle, they're being defeated by him, and they're saying, very well done, this boy is really good. You know, so this is kind of a code of chivalry that they had then, which is obviously long gone. In today's world, we see that, you know, not even armies, practically just bands of people posing as soldiers will wipe out civilian communities, go through villages, destroy everything, kill the women and children, kidnap them, you know, all these things. This was unheard of during the Vedic times, during the Vedic system, thousands of years ago. These were Kshatriyas. These were great warriors who fought, you know, with a certain code of ethics, a certain code of chivalry that was there. In fact, even it's mentioned that this battle was unfair. This was against the rules because it wasn't equals. It was six. If one of them would have taken on Samba, it would have been considered a fair fight. And Samba probably could have handled that. But here you had six great warriors all attacking one single person. So that was considered unjust. So this is the type of, this is the way that these things were carried on. And in fact, later we'll learn that much of this is all part of a certain Leela, and they all basically expected that Samba was going to end up with Lakshman, but they had to at least protest. They had to show a fight here, you know, that they just couldn't let this happen, that he would do this, take her away against her will in the middle of the Swayambhara sacrifice. So, you know, it was their duty and their honor was at stake. They had to go and try to attack and capture Samba, which they did. Now, what's interesting here, twice in these purports, it's quoted Srila Prabhupada's commentary in the Krishna book on this chapter. And in both of the very, very short purports we had here, they mention this word achinta, that Krishna is achinta, inconceivable. And therefore, Samba was also achinta, inconceivable. In fact, he fought so valiantly that he showed the same empowerment of his father, Krishna. And so, of course, it's he was the son of Jambavati, one of Krishna's main wives, one of the eight principal wives. I think she, was she the third wife? Anyway, she was one of the very first wives of Krishna. And so naturally, her son would be endowed with those same powers of Krishna, at least a portion of those powers of Krishna. So this word inconceivable or chinta is used here to describe Krishna and Samba. So as Madan Mohan was saying on Friday, that sometimes in these pastimes that are really basically telling stories, you try to find a word or two that gives you a philosophical point to expand upon. So I thought this was a natural one here to think about Krishna's achinta nature, his inconceivable powers. And that's certainly worth discussing and describing and further elaborating within the Srimad Bhagavatam. In fact, we could see that throughout these pastimes, Krishna's achinta nature, his inconceivable powers, are exhibited time and time again. If nothing else, sometimes we get from these pastimes, at least we understand this, that Krishna is God, Krishna is wonderful, Krishna is inconceivable, and he has fantastic powers, along with his expansions like his son Samba. So I thought there was a very interesting verse. If we go back to the Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 2, Chapter 9, Text 28. Now, this is the chapter where Lord Brahma approaches Krishna, and he's praying for creative potency. And, of course, then Krishna gives that, and he speaks, of course, the four nutshell verses, right? The four essential verses of the Bhagavatam are in this chapter. So this verse is a couple verses before that. I think it'll start on 31, somewhere in there. Madan, do you know? 33. Okay, this is back a few. This is 28. This is when Lord Brahma is, you know, kind of coming up to that point by offering glorification of Krishna and prayers for his ability to somehow or another create this whole material world. So glorifying Krishna in his questions, he's talking about how Krishna acts so wonderfully and inconceivably through his energies. He says, O master of all energies, please tell me philosophical all about them. You play like a spider that covers itself by its own energy, and your determination is infallible. Now, in this purport, I particularly pick this because of the purport, where Srila Prabhupada talks about these inconceivable energies that Krishna possesses. Prabhupada says, by the inconceivable energy of the Lord, every creative element has its own potency, known as the potency of the element, potency of knowledge, and potency of different actions and reactions. Please, no one ask me more about that later, because this is what I understand, what Srila Prabhupada has written here. It's very interesting. By a combination of such potencies of the Lord, there's a manifestation of creation, maintenance, and annihilation in due course of time, and by different agents like Brahma, Vishnu, and Maheshvara. But all such agents and creative energies are emanations from the Lord, and as such there is nothing except the Lord, or the one supreme source of different diversities. The exact example is that of a spider and a spider's web. The web is created by the spider, maintained by the spider, and as soon as the spider likes, the whole thing is wound up within the spider. The spider is covered within the web. If an insignificant spider is so powerful to act according to its will, why can't the supreme being act by his supreme will in the creation, maintenance, and destruction of the cosmic manifestation? So here we have this very nice example that is given in the Bhagavatam by Lord Brahma and expanded upon here by Srila Prabhupada of the spider and the web. How the spider has this potency to create a web and do all of this to manifest it and then bring it back within its body and to cover himself with this web. So certainly, if this is possible for an insignificant little, I was going to say insects, spiders aren't insects, what are they, arachnoids? Whatever, okay, by some insignificant living entity, like a spider, then certainly, I mean, what to speak of human beings, and then what to speak of the Supreme Personality of Godhead? Of course he has these abilities. So Krishna is able to pervade the entire universe, create the entire universe, and still remain separate and not lose his own identity. In the Bhagavad Gita 9.4, it says, by me, in my unmanifested form, this entire universe is pervaded. All beings are in me, but I am not in them. So the example is given by Srila Prabhupada in the purport of the king and his energy. how the king is present in all departments, yet he remains a person. So, I can just read this really quickly. It says, for example, this is from Prabhupada's report, a king heads the government, which is but the manifestation of the king's energy. The different governmental departments are nothing but the energies of the king, and each department is resting on the king's power. But still, one cannot expect the king to be present in every department personally. So, sometimes we say that Krishna is not personally present in this material world because he never touches matter. But of course, he creates matter. All matter, material energy is coming from him, but yet he remains aloof from it. How does this happen? This is his inconceivable potency. How does he manifest an energy, and yet he's detached from it and remains a person completely involved in the spiritual energy? The next verse of Bhagavad Gita says, and yet everything that is created does not rest in me. Behold my mystic opulence. That's what it is. Another name for achinta potency, mystic opulence. Although I am the maintainer of all living entities, and although I am everywhere, I am not a part of this cosmic manifestation, for myself is the very source of creation. So he simultaneously controls material nature, but is aloof. So when we think of this word achinta, naturally we think of a philosophical concept of achinta beta beta tattva. This is the philosophy of Krishna consciousness. Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's philosophy can be summarized in the words achinta beta beta tattva. So Lord Chaitanya took all of the main philosophical points and concepts from all the different sampradayas, and he distilled the essence of them and perfected them. You know, and the final resolution of the perfection of philosophy is in the achinta beta beta tattva. So what does it mean? It means Krishna and the living entities are one and different, qualitatively one, but quantitatively different. Krishna has both a personal and an impersonal feature, but he keeps his identity. That's another part of achinta beta beta tattva. Is it one and different? In other words, is Krishna everything? Yes, he is. But is he also separate? Yes, he is. He's both separate and different. Nothing is different from the absolute, but yet he acts through his varied energies, his variegated potencies. So Krishna and this creation can be understood through the understanding of Krishna's energies and how he connects through the expansion of energies, either spiritual energy or material energy. So we don't see this. When we look out at the material energy, for the most part, we see the material energy. At least most living entities, maybe you devotees, you're getting some transcendental vision and seeing Krishna working behind his energies. At least intellectually, we can understand it. You know, but for the most part, the living entity doesn't understand how Krishna is behind everything. Because just as the spider covers himself with his web, Krishna covers himself. He covers his vision from us. The example is given is just as if you compare Krishna to the sun beams down on the water and evaporates water into gaseous form and creates clouds. So the clouds are created by the sun. Now, when the clouds are in the sky, the sun is covered. You don't see the sun because they're covered by clouds, right? So in the same way, all this material energy is created by Krishna, but we don't see Krishna because the material energy covers us. It doesn't mean that the sun has gone away, and it doesn't mean that Krishna does not exist. We just cannot see it with these present eyes. So what happens when you have, let's say, the fog is there. That's another example. You have clouds. You also have fog that's created by water vapor, whatever. But you'll have fog in the morning. We see that a lot here, especially in the cooler months. And eventually, the sun comes up and burns away the fog. All the fog or the clouds are dissipated by the energy of the sun itself. So in the same way, by Krishna's mercy, he can burn away the coverings of illusion, the coverings of this material energy, so that we can see him. So basically, Krishna is seen when he reveals himself by his mercy. So how does that happen? Well, it doesn't happen just by us one day, Krishna. Well, sometimes it does. It could happen that Krishna, just by his mercy, reveals himself to us. But generally, you need to qualify yourself. Krishna doesn't so easily reveal himself to everyone, at least not in his... He reveals himself in his impersonal form or in the form of his material energy. But in terms of his actual personal form as Krishna Shyamasundar, not so easily revealed to the living entities. We need qualification. And that qualification comes about by the purifying process of bhakti yoga. When we purify ourselves, when we cleanse the material consciousness away through the process of devotional service, then Krishna reveals himself. Krishna says, bhakti mam ajan nanti yavanyascha smitatvataha ito mam tadvata gyatva vishite tadanantaram. One can understand me as I am, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, only by devotional service. And when one is in full consciousness of me by such devotion, he can enter into the kingdom of God. So, Krishna says directly in the Bhagavad Gita, how can you see me? Through bhakti, through the process of devotional service. In the purport, 1152 is actually very similar to 1855. You know, they're almost identical ideas. The two both talk about bhakti as being the ways of seeing Krishna. In the purport 1152, Prabhupada says, Krishna's covered by his yoga maya potency. He is not to be seen or revealed to anyone and everyone. Only by one to whom he reveals himself can he be seen. The transcendentalist, by continuous Krishna consciousness and devotional service to Krishna, can have his spiritual eyes open and can see Krishna by revelation. So, sometimes the Christians use this word revelation, and we don't use it so much, but once in a while, Prabhupada uses the word revelation because that's what it is. Revelation means to have some experience by something being revealed to one. And particularly, we talk about God revealing himself to the living entity. So, the spiritual eyes can be open. One can experience this revelation. Sometimes we talk about, what is another word we use, besides revelation, not quite so dramatic. Anyway, sometimes we say that, I'm looking for a word here. Realization. Thank you. That's it. You know, when you get to my age, sometimes things just slip. I'm sorry. Okay. Yeah. So sometimes we talk about realization. Realization is actually very similar to revelation. It's not quite as dramatic, you know, in terms of its term. But yes, Krishna gives us realization within the heart. And he reveals himself in many ways. Even to a very neophyte devotee, to a very beginning person, Krishna reveals himself. And there is some realization or understanding, and that something is going on there. And we see this even with people. You know, one thing I've always loved about Rath Yatras is watching the people who see Jagannath's chariot coming by. And sometimes you see that, you know, you see everything, every different reaction is possible. But you see some people just look like, wow, you know, like they're seeing something they've seen before, or it awakens something. You know, something opens up in their heart. You see that happen. And this is actually a fact, that that even a person who does not know much about Krishna consciousness can have their heart awakened by contact with Krishna consciousness. There's actually a word for this in the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. Rupa Goswami calls this Chaya Rati Abhasa. So what is this Chaya Rati Abhasa? It's called the resemblance of the splendor of bhakti. That's kind of how it's described or defined by Rupa Goswami and by the commentators. It's not exactly pure bhakti. It's actually under the section of bhava. It's a preliminary stage to bhava because sometimes it'll feel like bhava. Sometimes in the beginning, a new devotee will have some deep spiritual experience, you know, where one feels ecstatic, you know, much like the symptoms of bhava. But it's not real bhava, it's this Chaya Rati Abhasa. It's a resemblance of bhava bhakti. Sometimes it comes about just by curiosity, it's mentioned. And Rupa Goswami states in the next verse, that actually in 1.352.53, if you're keeping score at home, it says this may come about from seeing festivals. Rupa Goswami says this, festivals, by association of devotees, or by coming and seeing, being in the holy dham. So sometimes we see this. A friend of mine, a god brother, was telling me, I was in Vrindavan, and he was there with, he had remarried, I think his wife had died, and at any rate, I don't want to go into detail, that's not important, but he had married this woman who barely knew much about Krishna consciousness. He met her on a vegetarian matchmaking site or something, you know, like that. So she was a vegetarian. She came to the temple, was immediately attracted, and then she went to him with Vrindavan. She had been associated with Krishna consciousness all of about 2 months by this point. And she had just was totally ecstatic. She was in a state of almost ecstatic whatever for days by being in Vrindavan. I mean, this is a very dramatic example of this Chayaratyabhasa, that the association of the holy place and the devotees just had this profound effect. Now, what is the problem? The only problem, there's no problem, but Rupa Goswami does explain that this taste is unstable. It may not remain. It may be fleeting. It may last for some time and then diminish. In fact, I've had many devotees say to me that when they first came to Krishna consciousness, began chanting Hare Krishna, they felt very ecstatic. Then after a while, it kind of faded a little bit. They didn't feel quite so ecstatic, and it seemed harder to get that back. Well, it does, you know, because that's kind of like, it's, I don't know what you describe it as. It's kind of like the incentive, you know, the free door prize when you come to Krishna consciousness. You get this incentive by Krishna. You know, you get this little taste. You get this taste of, it's actually a taste of bhava, you know, this Chayaratyabhasa. But it does not remain. It has to be worked for after that to obtain a real state of devotional service and eventually going through the processes and the steps of bhakti up to the stage of bhava. Rupa Goswami explains, though, that this will become deeper. If a person experiences this, they're still very, very fortunate. Not like everybody experiences this. You know, not that everybody, when they see the Ratha-yatra parade, experiences ecstasy. Very small percentage do, or walks in the temple. I know people who have walked into a temple for the first time in their life, seen the deities, and just felt ecstatic and knew this was Krishna and this was God, and end of story. They're devotees. This happens. Sometimes these elements awaken that dormant bhakti that's within us. But to become deeper and become real requires the mercy of the devotees. This is what Rupa Goswami says. Through continued association, the Sadhu Sangha, the mercy of the devotees deepens this and it becomes real bhakti. It becomes lasting. Eventually, one goes to the stages of Anartanavritti and becomes steady, nishta. After that, then rati and the real ashakti, real attachment, and real taste comes about. So, the mercy of the devotees is so critical. The process of devotional service begins with faith in Krishna and Guru. Yasha devi para bhaktir yada devi tata gurau taishyaiti kaityaharta prakashanti mahatmana. Only by those great souls, only unto those great souls, who have implicit faith in both the Lord and the spiritual master, are all of the imports of Vedic knowledge automatically revealed. Famous verse from the Svetashvatara Upanishad, 6:23. So, only those who have faith in the Lord and the spiritual master. So, such an important thing that we not only come to the lotus feet of Krishna and accept Krishna, but we have to accept the spiritual master. And having implicit faith means implicit faith in the instructions and the words of the spiritual master. Not just, oh, I have a guru, oh, I have a wonderful guru, I want to go see my guru. And, you know, it's not like something for our enjoyment, you know. I get some special thrill out of seeing my guru. No, well, of course we do, but the real benefit of the contact, the relationship, the attachment to the guru is in following the instructions of the guru and thus getting the mercy. So the instructions of the spiritual master become the life and soul of the devotees. I was thinking, we had just the other night, we had our memorial for Brahmananda Prabhu. And Brahmananda Prabhu is one of those really, really wonderful devotees, of course, and we think about him, and, you know, he is, if you hear the memory tapes, you know, he has some great memories. He has just fantastic stories on those memory tapes. And when I think of Brahmananda, I don't necessarily think of a great scholar. Maybe he was, I don't know. But that's not what we know him for, is it? It's not really like, you know, he memorized the whole Bhagavad Gita or something. I don't know if he did or not. But what we remember him for is his devotion to Prabhupada, isn't it? There was no question, and I didn't really know Brahmananda, that's why I didn't speak about him, but, you know, I'd seen him around and I heard about him, and basically the thing that you could tell was his complete devotion to Prabhupada. And that's, I think of other great devotees that we think about, like Jayananda Prabhu, and that's kind of a hallmark. It's the thing that stands out about them. They were just completely, completely dedicated to Prabhupada. And, I mean, I could name so many devotees, and, you know, he had such great servants. And I was thinking of, recently I've had the privilege of having some, a little more association, some, I've been working with Shruti Kirti Prabhu. And Shruti Kirti, we all remember him as when he was Prabhupada's servant for a couple of years. And Shruti Kirti was fairly simple. I mean, you know, he was guileless. You know, there was no agenda with him. He was just wanting to serve Prabhupada all the time. And he just had complete faith in Prabhupada, and he just would serve whatever Prabhupada wanted and whatever his desire was. And, you know, these are these wonderful qualities of devotees who have this devotion to Guru. And then, of course, that attachment to Krishna comes about automatically. It comes about, you know, because what is the Guru telling us? The Guru is saying, serve Krishna, love Krishna, have devotion, bhakti to Krishna. Those are his instructions. So we are working for Krishna all the time, working for Lord Chaitanya, according to the instructions of the Guru. And that we know is what really pleases him. Yeah. I go to Panihati in Atlanta every year. We just had it a couple weeks ago. And, you know, we always have one morning where we tell a story where Prabhupada remembrances, and they're really nice. And, of course, the Atlanta devotees always tell their stories, and they all tell the same stories every year. And, you know, it's like we all expect the same stories, but they're great stories, you know. So it's fine. It's kind of like, you know, you never pick up the Krishna because, oh, I've already read that story. No, it's fresh and new and nectarian every time we hear it. So every time we hear the Atlanta devotees telling their same story year after year, it's always wonderful. You know, and they always tell the story of, you know, when Prabhupada went to Atlanta, which is, by the way, right after he was in Miami, and I never remember, Sukhita, was that 74 when Prabhupada came? Or 75, was it? I can't remember. Anyway, was anybody else in Miami? Sukhita and I were, and anyway, when Prabhupada came, that was very wonderful, but I am diverging from my story here. And, but right after that, he went to Atlanta. And for some reason, Miami was kind of nice because there weren't many other people besides the Miami devotees. And actually, we got some association with Prabhupada there. But in Atlanta, apparently, everybody came. The whole Radha-Damodar party came, like all the buses and, you know, lots and lots of devotees. And so the temple room is filled. They love to tell the story. And one of the Radha-Damodar devotees, of course, they've been really into book distribution. Everyone knew how much Prabhupada loved book distribution. He loved to hear the scores. He loved to hear how his books were being sold all over the world. And we should remember that to this day. I hear there's book tables going out. Let's continue to please Srila Prabhupada this way. So anyway, one of the boys said, "What pleases you, Srila Prabhupada?" And of course, Srila Prabhupada said that you love Krishna. So they were expecting maybe a little different answer, but Prabhupada gave the perfect answer. And everybody was satisfied. Everybody was pleased. The book distributors were pleased. The temple devotees were pleased that you love Krishna. That is what pleases the spiritual master, that we're developing a love for Krishna. Because that's the spiritual master's only goal, is to please Krishna and to love Krishna. And he wants to bring his disciples to the lotus feet of Shishi Radhashyama Sundar. So we can reach lotus feet of Radhashyama Sundar through our love for Prabhupada, our love for our guru, following those instructions. And that will be the perfection of our life. Okay, I'll stop at that point. Prabhupada. Any Discussion. Madame Mahaprabhu.
When you were talking about the shadow attachment, I think you stated I wasn't familiar with it. Chaita, how did you say it? Chaya.
Chaya. Chaya Rati Abhasa.
So it seemed to me that it's like you get a free trial. You get bliss without any payments due for the anartha nivritti.
That's
state.
The word I was looking for. The free trial.
Yeah. No payments due till next
year.
And I was also wondering if that could be interacted with that verse 2.3.24, certainly that heart of steel frame, that in spite of experiencing bliss, that the heart doesn't change. So it seems you could hook that up with the anartha nivritti stage, that here you're doing this, so now I've already, you know, what more can Krishna do? He's already given you the bliss of his association, now the payment, anartha nivritti, is due.
Yeah, that's a real nice point. Thank you. And nice connection there on those verses. Because I often thought I didn't quite understand that verse from the Bhagavatam, because despite, you know, one is experiencing bliss, the heart remains still framed. You think, well, why would that be? How could you, you know, how could one come and then still the heart is still framed? And that's a good explanation of it, that one might obtain that original, you know, Shayabhata Abhasa, or, you know, that taste, but then yet one doesn't really change and go through the anartha nivritti stage of working to purify oneself, because it's only the purified heart that ultimately understands Krishna. Yeah, go ahead. Are you next? Go ahead. Somebody.
This word, Chayarati Avas, it's coming from Rupa Goswami Pad's sweet description of definition of Shuddha Satta Visheshatma. And Prabhupada translated, when the devotional service is performed on the pure goodness, one heart will soften and he will relish. And then Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, he breaks down that has a two division. One is Chaya Roti Avas. It's related to Krishna. Krishna Prem is like a tree, and the tree has a shadow. And when a devotee joins in Krishna consciousness, he's coming in contact with the shadow, not with Krishna and Krishna Prem directly. But because he's following the shadow, eventually the shadow will lead to the tree. But the path is little bit tremble, anartha nivritti, and all this.
Yeah, just before you go, I think Prabhupada used that, defines it as the shadow attachment.
Yes.
Right? That's the word Prabhupada used. Yeah, thank you. Go ahead.
And then there is another group who also comes to spiritual practice. They are called Pratibimba Roti Avas. And Pratibimba Roti Avas is compared to seeing Krishna or Krishna Prem in a mirror. And from afar, he is seeing in the mirror, but mirror does not have a connection with the substance. So as a result, if he proceed towards there, even if he break to find the person, he will never be found, and he will be disappointed. And that is not applicable to the devotee.
Yeah, the pratibimba is farther removed, isn't it? I mean, it's not, the chayaratabhasa is more advanced than the pratibimba. Yeah. Yeah, that's all described in that third chapter, the Bhakti Samrita Sindhu and the family. It's very, very interesting. Yeah, and then of course the Nectar Devotion, Prabhupada also explains some. Yeah,
I have a little comment and a question. You spoke about implicit faith, and I always what came to my mind that I always admire is the Sikh community. There are millions of Sikhs in India, Hindus. In their temples, they don't have any deities. They don't have any murtis of the Guru Nanak. They worship the book. It's called Gantaram.
They worship what?
His book.
Book. Okay.
That's the only worship that goes on in Sikh temple. Yeah. So, have an implicit faith. My question is, you said that everyone is in Krishna, but he's not in them. It may be a little confusing to some when you think about the Kisara Dakshai Vishu, Paramatma, manifestation.
Yeah. I think the question is, Krishna says, you know, that I am pervading everything, but I am not in them. But then what about the Paramatma? Yeah, obviously. It's kind of like one and different. It's, again, it's that inconceivable one and difference. You know, that Krishna says, you know, I am not in them, but obviously Krishna pervades everything. He pervades everything through his Brahman energy. He pervades the entire universe through his Paramatma energy, the super souls in the heart, every living entity, and Prabhupada said within every atom and between every atom. So obviously, Krishna pervades everything. But when he says, but I am not, he means, but his personal form does not become lost. What Krishna is trying to say is, I don't distribute all my energies, and then, because that's the impersonal conception, right? In other words, the sum total of everything is God. You know, it's all divert, it's all dispersed. But Krishna is saying, I can do that, I can pervade everything, and yet I can still remain Krishna in Goloka Vrindavan. You know, I still remain aloof. Yeah, that's his achinta potency. Yeah, Jivana. Right, the last one.
Okay, maybe I shouldn't be the last one.
I'm sorry, any ladies? Okay, a couple ladies then. Okay.
I just want to say how you were talking about that initial attraction that you've seen before or experienced before. When I first came in contact with a friend of mine who happened to be a devotee, which is why I was interested, gave me a bit of literature, decided to go to Mangalarti. He said, come see God. So I thought, great, and I go to the Philadelphia temple. And I went to Mangalarti first. I never spoke to any other devotee. And in Philadelphia at that time, they had one set of deities. So I was going to go see God. And I had my Christian background in the back of my head getting ready to see God. And the curtains opened, and there was Jagannath. And I went, okay. And I thought, well, why not? Everything else I read was pretty far out, so why not? So I didn't have that initial, oh, the Lord. I just went, okay. But it grew on me because the kirtan was pretty ecstatic. So
I had the same experience. First deities I saw were Jagannath. And that's what I thought. Okay, sure, why not? Makes sense. I mean, everything else makes sense. Why not, Lord Jagannath? Lord of the universe. Okay, I think we had Ravina Mahaney and
I was just trying to understand Pratibimbabhas. Do you have an example of that? Like mentioning about how the Chayarati, the tree, and that's understandable. We go through that.
Yeah.
But I was trying to understand what is Pratibimbabhas.
You know, I was mostly just reviewing the other one, and I didn't really read very carefully on the Pratibimba. It's more Mayavadi? Okay. Okay, so the Pratibimba example, or this is the reflection, would be like the Mayavadi impersonal who has some, you know, does some initial devotion or shows some devotion, but they don't really believe, don't really have faith in the form of God. Okay, very good, thank you.
Yeah. I just wanted to share one story since you mentioned how important is the contact with the devotee. I joined the preaching center, so one day we were invited to go in somebody's house and show them how to cook. And they were a really young couple, and they had a little baby, I mean, really little, and she named the baby Bhima. And it was the smallest baby ever I have seen. So I asked her, why did you name this baby Bhima? And she said, I just like the name. I said, how long do you know about Krishna consciousness? So she said, when I married my husband, I didn't know that he was devotee. He actually was devotee, and then he left. And he never told her anything about Krishna. And she said, when I was cleaning through the house, I found the books. And I started reading, and I asked him, what is this? And why did you never tell me about this? And he said, well, I was scared that you are not going to like it. So I never wanted to show that side, that I was devotee. And she said, but I love it. And actually, she started introducing Krishna consciousness in the house and cooking and everything. So even she didn't know he was devotee, she became devotee.
Thank you. Very wonderful story. There's so many nice stories like that, where people just have some contact with the books or some contact with a devotee, and their lives change completely. And that is interesting how sometimes, through that contact, how the other person becomes the devotee and actually becomes, you know, maybe the stronger devotee and helps bring him back to Krishna consciousness. Thank you very much. Okay, all glories to Srila Prabhupada.